Before I forget, I wanted to say that on the day of the final, which is what, Wednesday? I can't promise absolutely because unfortunately instructors don't have access to this control of this door. It's controlled remotely by Tempe. But I called him and supposedly as long as I call them that morning, I can get it open by 6:45. So I don't want anyone to be time stressed, especially if you're taking two tests that day for the people who are opting for the remake. And if you have to leave right after, then you can show up as early as 6:45 and start right away. All right, so same deal. As you come in, people will already be taking a test, so come in quietly whenever you do show up. Hopefully that'll be enough time for everyone. Okay? You don't have to get here at 6:45, but I'll be here. That leaves us with 3 days to finish up the material. All we have left are 3 chapters, so chapter a day. It's actually seems like a lot of material in terms of number of chapters, but these last few chapters actually don't take as long as the other ones to get through, so I think we can actually do it. The chapter we're starting today is about mitosis and the cell cycle. And I'm sure you've talked about mitosis in other... Well, you definitely have gone through mitosis before. So this should go fairly quickly, but we're going to go through it again. The cell cycle, schematized by this circle on the bottom here, really refers to the entire lifetime of a cell. A cell is a little bit different from a pregnant woman. When a pregnant woman gives birth, she continues to exist. Well, usually. Nowadays, it's usually she survives that process and continues to exist. But when a cell gives birth, in a sense, to 2 new cells, that original cell is no longer there. So the cell cycle is the time from when a cell is first created to when it ends its own life by splitting into 2 new cells. Right? Cell theory tells us that nowadays, and it's been this way for a long time, all cells come from pre-existing cells. Cells don't just pop into existence anymore like they did for those original cells because conditions are totally different on Earth now. So the start-finish line of the circular diagram representing the cell cycle is a division event. And the overall cell cycle consists of 2 major subdivisions, which are interphase, most of the circle here. The outer band here represents interphase. And then the shorter M phase, M here standing for mitotic. Now, somewhat confusingly, the mitotic phase includes more than just mitosis, for which it's named. So the mitotic phase and mitosis are not the same thing. Mitosis occurs in the mitotic phase, or M phase, but so does cytokinesis. All right, so cell division is more than just mitosis. What is mitosis specifically? Division of the nucleus and its contents, which is why this applies only, of course, to eukaryotic cells. They're the only ones with nuclei. So mitosis divides the nucleus. That doesn't get you 2 cells, though. If all that occurs, if that's the only thing that occurs, and sometimes that happens in certain cells, then what you have is 1 cell with 2 nuclei now, right? If you're doing this, though, for the purpose of having 2 overall cells, in which each of those 2 cells has 1 of those 2 nuclei that are created by mitosis, then you also need to split the rest of the cell besides the nucleus, which collectively is the cytoplasm, right? That's what cytokinesis is, division of the cytoplasm. And in most cases, mitosis and cytokinesis happen hand in hand. They both occur, in other words, and therefore what's created overall after both of those processes are complete are two cells that are genetically identical to the original cell, and the original cell no longer exists. All right, that therefore is the end of the cell cycle for that cell that split, and it's the very beginning of the cell cycle for each of the two brand new cells. That's the start line of their own cell cycle. So those are the two major subdivisions, interphase and the M phase. But notice that interphase, which is one major subdivision, itself is subdivided into stages, which we abbreviate as G1, S, and G2. Those occur in that order, G1 first, then S, then G2. All of them combined make up interphase. G here, for both 1 and 2, refers to gap, although that's a misnomer, because that implies that nothing is happening during G1 and G2. Of course, that's untrue. There's a lot of things happening. S stands for synthesis, specifically DNA synthesis. So remember the two jobs of DNA, replication and transcription. Well, those are both happening in the cell cycle, but the replication part is in the S phase. All right, now the G1 part of interphase is, first of all, it's the most variable in terms of length of the overall, how long it lasts. It's variable, it's more highly variable than the other substages. And it's highly variable because there are different kinds of cells within a multicellular organism. So it can be hours in some cells, it can be a lifetime in some cells. Like a neuron, for instance. Typical neuron does not divide. So it's going to be in G1 for your life. But anyway, the G1 phase, whatever cell it's occurring in, G1 can be thought of as the normal lifetime of that cell, whatever kind of cell it is. It's not its entire lifetime, but it's the lifetime with respect to doing whatever that cell is supposed to be doing, acting like whatever kind of cell it is. And it's not yet thinking, in a sense, about splitting into two new cells. Everything after G1 occurs after that cell has committed to preparing and then going through with the act of dividing into two cells, beginning with S. The S phase is DNA synthesis, DNA replication. Well, a cell doesn't replicate its DNA until it's ready to have two copies, one for each of two cells that it's about to become. So at the G1 to S transition, the cell has already made the decision, okay, I'm retired as far as being a hepatocyte or whatever kind of cell it is. It's time now to make two new cells. G2 then, which follows replication, still part of interphase, but it's the last part of interphase, that really involves a bunch of things that get ready for the M phase. But in both G1 and G2, there's a lot of transcription occurring. There's replication of DNA in S, but in G1 and G2, there's a lot of transcription. In the G1, the transcription is to make the proteins necessary for being that kind of cell, right? And in G2, it's turning on different kinds of genes because those genes are involved in preparing the cell to enter mitosis. Now, M here is shown as just one overall primary subdivision of the cell cycle, but if you got in here and looked at the details, as we see by looking at the top of the screen, the M phase also has subphases to it. First of all, it has two major subphases, mitosis itself and cytokinesis, which do not butt up against each other, meaning that mitosis doesn't end before cytokinesis begins, and that's illustrated by the shading at the right end of mitosis and the left end of cytokinesis here. Instead, they overlap temporally. So cytokinesis begins before mitosis is completed. Anyway, those are two subdivisions of the M subdivision, mitosis and cytokinesis. Mitosis itself, then, can be split into five subphases, which we'll look at, and you should already know these. What are they in order? Prophase, prometaphase, metaphase, anaphase, telophase. So in a typical cell, telophase will proceed as the beginning of cytokinesis is happening. That's the overlap I was talking about. Well, now we can see in slide 2 these five subphases along with interphase. So mitosis starts on the second picture, not the first. Keep that in mind here. But by looking at the cartoon versions of the cells, we can see the important events that happen in each of these. So in interphase here, we haven't entered the M phase yet in the cell cycle, obviously. This is still in interphase. And this specifically is late interphase, so it's G2. And therefore, this cell has already gone through the S phase. And the S phase main event is DNA replication. So you don't see any chromosomes in this at this time because chromosomes are highly condensed chromatin, right? The chromatin is not highly condensed here so that it's accessible for transcription. But the amount of DNA that's in the chromatin in late interphase, G2 interphase, is actually enough DNA for two cells already because it's already passed through the S phase. So when these, when this chromatin eventually condenses to the point where we can call it chromosomes, there will be enough DNA in those chromosomes for two cells already. Mitosis does not produce the extra DNA. That's already done in S phase. So notice that what we have here is an intact nuclear envelope. We have chromatin that is not condensed yet. Also occurring in S phase, by the way, is a replication of the centrosome. You start out with one centrosome. You replicate the centrosome. Now there are two centrosomes, each with their centrioles, remember. And it's necessary for there to be two centrosomes for mitosis to occur, as we'll talk about. But at the moment, they are more or less right beside each other, the centrosomes, that is. Now we can enter mitosis, and the earliest phase within that is prophase. And the things that happen in prophase are the condensing of the chromatin into chromosomes. And notice that these chromosomes are bigger than they will appear later, and that's because the condensing has just started. It proceeds through a few phases of mitosis. It gets more and more condensed as we proceed. But by now, the chromatin has condensed to the point where we can actually see discrete or individual chromosomes rather than just a gray area within the nucleus under light microscopy. And notice in each of these purple chromosomes that they're double the amount of DNA that they would need to be for it to be a single chromosome. They are really, in effect, two chromosomes, but we consider those two exact copies of each other, which are connected to each other, one chromosome. All right. Now, an important thing about mitosis is that it maintains the ploidy of the cell. So whatever the ploidy is for the cell that enters mitosis, the two cells that are created out of the mitosis are the same ploidy as that original cell. All right. Well, the two identical copies of each strand of DNA, or each double helix of DNA and its associated proteins, are called chromatids, sister chromatids. And each sister chromatid will eventually be a chromosome in its own right, but not yet. This is just a word game we're playing here. We call them sister chromatids when they are still connected to each other at a part somewhere along the length of these chromatids called the centromere. All right, two identical copies, and they're identical because of the S phase causing replication. Two identical copies connected at a centromere make up one replicated chromosome. So at this point, there are some number of replicated chromosomes. That number depends on the species, right? Every species has its own number of different kinds of chromosomes. In this simple example, there are four kinds of chromosomes. Okay. In this example, which is a diploid organism, there are two kinds of chromosomes, but there are two of each of those kinds of chromosomes. The point is, the four things we see here, each of those is considered one chromosome, even though it's enough DNA for two. It's one replicated chromosome in each of these four. Now, that's prophase. You still have an intact nuclear envelope. You see the chromosomes therein starting to condense. And the centrosomes, which are outside of the nucleus, start forming an early mitotic spindle, which is made up of microtubules that grow from the centrosomes. And they are pushing on each other. The microtubules from each centrosome are pushing on each other, forcing the two centrosomes to move apart, to go to opposite ends of the cell. In other words, to polarize. All right? That's prophase. Prometaphase has an important event, which is the disintegration of the nuclear envelope. The nuclear envelope, at this point, is a barrier that needs to be gotten rid of because the mitotic spindle that's developing is outside of the nucleus, and it has to interact with the chromosomes, which are inside the nucleus. Therefore, the nuclear envelope is between these two things that need to come together. So, in most cells, the nuclear envelope disintegrates. And that's the major event in prometaphase. But also notice that by the time we get to prometaphase, the polarization of the two centrosomes is maximized. They are as far apart as they're going to be now. And the mitotic spindle has developed to a greater degree. Also, since the nuclear envelope is no longer in the way, some of the microtubules of the mitotic spindle are attached to places on the centromeres of the replicated chromosomes. And those places on those replicated chromosomes at the centromeres are called kinetochores. All right? The name of which implies that they're going to be involved in some movement, right? Kinetic. So the kinetochores, well, there's two kinetochores on each centromere. There's a single centromere for a replicated chromosome, right? Two sister chromatids attach at the centromere. That centromere has a kinetochore on either side of the centromere. And so there are two connection points for microtubules of the mitotic spindle on one side of the centromere and on the other side of the centromere. So on one side of the centromere, microtubules get attached that are those are microtubules that are at their other end attached to one centrosome, and then attaching to the other side of the centromere at the other kinetochore are microtubules that are emanating from the other centrosome. All right, now to metaphase. The big event in metaphase, and what really defines it, is that movement of these attached replicated chromosomes, attached meaning attached to the microtubules of the mitotic spindle, movement of these replicated chromosomes is such that they line up halfway between the two poles. The poles, by the way, are the two centrosomes that have moved apart from each other. Right? And so we're looking at this in two dimensions. It looks like they're lining up, but really this is three dimensions, right? It's a three-dimensional cell. So they can be anywhere in the plane that is halfway between the two poles. They don't have to actually be lined up. They're just all in that plane. And that plane we call either the equatorial plane, Well, actually, plane or plate, it could be called. It's not actually a... It's just an imaginary mathematical plane, right? But it's halfway between the two poles. And so, basically, these replicated chromosomes are being pulled with equal force toward each of the two poles, which is ends up them being halfway between, but they're being tugged on. All right, anaphase follows that, and the big event in anaphase is that something divides. This is mitosis. So what divides in mitosis? Well, I'll ask you, what is it that splits apart? Sister chromatids separate from each other in mitosis. And this is where we play the word game. As soon as the sister chromatids are separated from each other, they're no longer called chromatids. Now each one is its own chromosome, but it's an unreplicated chromosome. In other words, it's a chromosome with enough DNA for just one cell. All right? So you might think that the ploidy here is doubling, because you're going from having some number of chromosomes to having twice that amount. And it does, in a sense, except that you're going to end up with two cells. So you multiply by two and divide by two, you're back at the same number. Okay? But anaphase is the period during which the separated chromosomes, formerly chromatids, are moving apart, are moving away from each other, guided by the microtubules of the mitotic spindle that they're connected to, and they're moving toward the pole that they're associated with. The former sister chromatid, that's an exact copy of it, is going to be moving in the opposite direction toward the other pole. Okay, so telophase is the final part of mitosis, and that's what I said overlaps cytokinesis, the beginning of cytokinesis. Telophase refers to these unreplicated chromosomes that are on their own reaching the two poles and a brand new nucleus forming, a new nuclear envelope forming, creating a new nucleus at each of those two poles. All right, that's just the mitotic part of it. That's the telophase aspect of it. But at the same time, this is an animal cell we're looking at as an example, cytokinesis begins, which in the animal version consists in the formation of a cleavage furrow. Cytokinesis in animals proceeds via what is called cleavage, which refers to cutting in half, right? And so we can see this cleavage furrow developing. That's the cytokinesis part here. But already we're having two brand new nuclei. Well, those two brand new nuclei will be by themselves in its own cell by the time cytokinesis is complete. And so what you end up with are two daughter cells, as they're called, that are identical to each other, genetically identical to each other, and also genetically identical to the original cell. By the way, mitosis and cytokinesis, the two parts of cell division, don't have to be equally careful processes. Which one has to be the much more careful process? Mitosis. Because it's important for each daughter cell to have the full library of DNA. And the same is true for the other. So you can't undergo DNA replication in the S phase, and then when it comes to mitosis, say, okay, this daughter cell gets roughly half of the DNA, whatever it is, maybe two chromosome number threes, you know, and the other one gets roughly half of the DNA. The DNA has to be exactly the same in each of the two cells in order for them to be viable cells. On the other hand, cytokinesis doesn't have to be that careful. It is okay for cytokinesis to say, okay, this daughter cell gets roughly half of the cytoplasm and what's in it. Because if you need something that's not in the cytoplasm, you just go to the DNA drawing board, right, or library to get the plans for how to build that thing you need. All right, but so, you know, it's, or if it's mitochondria, for instance, mitochondria replicate themselves just like bacteria do. So as long as each one has some mitochondria, it's not necessary that exactly half of the mitochondria go one way and half the other way. We're on slide 3 now, and this is just a close-up of the kinetochores I was talking about. So this isn't the entire, well, this is the entire replicated chromosome, but we're a close-up view of just the centromere here, the place where the two sister chromatids come together. And what I said before is shown in pictures here. On one side of the centromere, you have a kinetochore and another one on the other side. The kinetochores at first are unbound to microtubules, but as the as mitosis proceeds through prometaphase, that's when the nuclear envelope disintegrates, remember, you have the ability of microtubules of the mitotic spindle to connect to proteins that make up the kinetochore. And that's what we see here. This one happens to already have that happened on one side. It hasn't happened yet on the other side. So this fibrous corona that's labeled here, that's not something that's permanent. That just means this kinetochore hasn't yet been bound to microtubules, but it will be. Okay? But the microtubules on one kinetochore will be associated at their other end with one centrosome, whereas the microtubules on the other kinetochore of that same centromere will be associated at their other end with the other centrosome. Slide 4. Here we're looking at anaphase, which is, of course, the division, right? Well, the top is metaphase, but the second and third diagrams in here are anaphase, and there are two aspects to anaphase, which is why we distinguish them as anaphase A and anaphase B. Well, let me, to differentiate between these, let me define two different kinds of microtubules. They're made up of identically the same stuff. But the mitotic spindle, which is made up of the centrosomes plus microtubules, those microtubules come in two varieties, even though they're made of the same stuff. They operate differently, the two categories. So there are what are called kinetochore microtubules, which you probably guess are the ones that actually connect to kinetochores of replicated chromosomes. Those are some of the microtubules, and the others that are not connected to kinetochores are called polar microtubules. And even though they're not connected to kinetochores, they're not connected to the chromosomes, in other words, they're still important in the overall mitotic process. Anaphase A, which you see in the middle of the diagram, refers to what anaphase really is taught as, which is the separation of the now unreplicated chromosomes moving toward their poles. So this involves the kinetochore microtubules. The kinetochore microtubules are roadways along which unreplicated chromosomes are being led toward one pole or the other, the centrosome. All right? So, because of kinetochore microtubules, you have separation of the now unreplicated chromosomes. But while this is happening, at the same time, the cell is elongating. And the mitotic spindle inside that cell is elongating, which is really causing the elongation of the cell. A cell that's going to split in the middle first gets longer, and then the cleavage furrow develops as part of cytokinesis. Well, that's what anaphase B is about. Anaphase B involves interaction of and overlap between polar microtubules, which are not connected to kinetochores. And so these microtubules, whether they're kinetochore or polar microtubules, they grow mostly at their plus ends away from the centrosomes, right? So the centrosomes are microtubule organizing centers, remember? These microtubules have their minus ends at the centrosomes and their plus ends away from the centrosomes. That's the direction in which they grow, mostly, away from the centrosomes. So as the mitotic spindle develops, at each centrosome, it's really kind of casting out a length of microtubule, some of which will be lucky enough to connect to a kinetochore, okay, of a chromosome. That binding to the kinetochore stabilizes the plus end. Remember, the plus ends can be unstable, and therefore, after growing, they can disintegrate right away. All right, so the ones that actually, it's like casting for fish. The ones that actually get hooked by a kinetochore, that'll stabilize them. Some of them also get hooked by another microtubule coming from the other centrosome, and those get stabilized as well. Those become the polar microtubules. Others don't hit anything, basically, and therefore they just immediately disintegrate. So the centrosome is creating more microtubules than you see in the mature spindle. The mature spindle is made up of microtubules that actually catch something, basically. But as these polar microtubules interact with each other, they continue to grow in length and therefore increase their overlap between each other. But then that overlap is decreased as motor proteins interacting between them force them apart. We talked about motor proteins in terms of a motor protein carrying a vesicle and walking along a microtubule. Well, you can also have a motor protein walking along one microtubule, and instead of carrying a vesicle, it's attached to the other microtubule. And so that is what causes the decrease in overlap, and that pushes the two centrosomes apart. That's anaphase B. We can kind of see that in slide 5. On the top, you have a kinetochore microtubule attached, well, a pair of them, one from each centrosome, attached at their plus ends to the kinetochores of a replicated chromosome. But the other ones, the microtubules on the bottom of this same piece of the spindle, are polar microtubules overlapping with the red things. Those are proteins that are stabilizing these microtubules, keeping them from disintegrating. But not shown in here are motor proteins associated with these red proteins that allow them to walk along the other microtubule, changing the degree of overlap between them. By the way, I didn't mention astral microtubules. So there's really three overall classes of microtubules. I shouldn't have said there's two. There are three overall. There's two that are involved between the two centrosomes. Okay, that's the part that actually is spindle-shaped, because to be spindle-shaped means it's fatter in the middle and then pointed at the ends. But the overall spindle actually includes more than just what is spindle-shaped. On the outsides of the centrosomes, so not between the two centrosomes, are what are called asters. And what does aster mean? Aster? Astral? What does the adjective astral mean? It means of an aster, yes, but star. Asterisk. Astral means of a star. So the aster, there's two asters, one for each centrosome, is the region of the mitotic spindle from one centrosome toward the plasma membrane. Okay? It's just a star-like in appearance. That's why it was called that. So the microtubules, also made of exactly the same stuff, in that region are called astral microtubules. All right? I'll show you why they're important in a different slide, namely slide 6. So we can see all three kinds of microtubules operating here. In anaphase, the movement or the migration of an unreplicated chromosome toward its pole is caused by actually the action of two different motor proteins. At the plus end, you have a motor protein walking the chromosome along the microtubule and digesting subunits along, kind of like walking on a road and then getting rid of the road behind it because it's only going to use that road once. Okay, so you can see the subunits being taken off one at a time at the plus end. At the same time, that alone would cause it to move toward the pole. But at the same time, you kind of have a reeling in motion at the centrosome end, the minus end. Motor proteins there are dragging the whole microtubule inward and dismantling it one subunit at a time at the minus end. So the microtubules are getting shorter, and just that by itself would reel in the chromosome, but both are happening at once, which makes it even faster. All right, that's what's happening at number one here on the figure. At number two, you have motor proteins doing what I was saying before, walking the microtubules with respect to each other so that the overlap decreases. After the overlap is formed, then it decreases. That pushes the two poles apart. And that alone would cause an increase in the length of the cell. But helping along with that are motor proteins associated with the cortex of the cytoskeleton, which is the part of the cytoskeleton on just the interior surface of the plasma membrane. Those motor proteins then interact with astral microtubules of the mitotic spindle, walking along them and dismantling them as they go. But that has the effect of pulling each centrosome toward the plasma membrane in that direction. So they're pulling while the polar microtubules are pushing, and that helps to lengthen the whole mitotic spindle and therefore the entire cell. All right, that is mitosis. Now in 7, we're looking at the animal version of cytokinesis. And cytokinesis is fundamentally different in an animal versus a non-animal cell. Because animals don't have cell walls in addition to their plasma membranes. All cells have plasma membranes. All plasma membranes are pretty flimsy. And therefore, if that's all you have, the cell is kind of like a very pliable balloon, water balloon. And that's why in animal cells, cytokinesis works as cleavage. A cleavage furrow, which means ditch, develops. Not just anywhere, though. The cleavage furrow is really in the same position as what we named either the equatorial plane or the metaphase plate earlier, halfway between the two poles. All right? And the way that this happens involves still other motor proteins. Now, we talked about the interaction between actin and myosin before, right? Actin is one of the three kinds of cytoskeletal proteins. But we talked about actin in most detail in reference to skeletal muscle cells. And actin and myosin interacting cause the sarcomeres to contract, right? Well, actin is also involved in cytokinesis in animal cells. And a ring of actin microfilaments, actin are not microtubules, remember, they're microfilaments. A ring of actin microfilaments develops inside the plasma membrane, but just inside to its surface, and it gets associated with a different version of myosin, non-muscle myosin, but works similarly, that is associated with the interior surface of the plasma membrane. So in a sense, these myosin molecules on the inner surface of the plasma membrane are like belt loops on the inside of pants rather than the outside. And the circle of actin microfilaments are like a belt. And if you make that belt shorter, which is what happens when you have the interaction between these motor proteins and the actin, the circle gets smaller and smaller. That's like cinching up the belt, which will pull on the loops from inside and make the whole plasma membrane come in as a cleavage furrow. It's happening all along the metaphase plate, and therefore, when it gets drastic enough, or when the ring gets small enough, the two plasma membrane pieces that were on opposite sides of the cells will basically pinch off and you have two distinct cells at that point. And each one already has its own nucleus because of mitosis that occurred right before this was occurring. Well, the story is a little bit different in plant cells. In slide 8, we're looking at cytokinesis in a plant cell. They have a plasma membrane, but they also have a cell wall that's pretty tough outside of that. So there is no cleavage furrow that develops in plant cells. Instead, cytokinesis in plant cells occurs by the formation of what's called a cell plate first, which eventually will become a new cell wall between two distinct cells. Now, the cell plate that's forming here is not actually a cell plate yet. Notice that it's midway, that you have pieces of it that are forming midway between the two poles at the same position, in other words, where cleavage would occur in an animal cell. But these things are just vesicles that bud off of the endoplasmic reticulum. They are special vesicles, though, that contain the materials that make up cell wall. All right, but vesicles are... any kind of vesicle, remember, is made of membrane. The wall of it is made of membrane. So what you really have here is, for each vesicle, is cell wall material on the inside coated by which the same stuff as plasma membrane is made out of. As those get bigger and bigger and more numerous, they coalesce. They come together and form bigger and bigger chunks until you finally have a cell plate. Now, this cell plate is really a piece of cell wall inside, coated all the way around by membrane material. And as that gets even bigger, eventually it will meet the plasma membrane of the cell itself. And at that point, you have two official cells. What we used to call the inside of the cell plate is really now outside of both cells, and it's just a cell wall like the original cell walls. And the piece of membrane on this side of it is part of the plasma membrane of this cell. The other side's membrane is now part of the plasma membrane of the other cell. All right. Let's go to 9. We've been talking about cell division in eukaryotes, but of course other cells, prokaryotes, divide as well, and they are the drastic majority of cells, remember. Most cells that are alive right at this moment, and most cells that have existed at any moment in the history of life, are prokaryotic cells. We are the minority. Well, anyway, they divide by something other than mitosis, of course, because mitosis, by definition, is division of the nucleus, which they don't have, by definition. So most prokaryotes, like a typical bacterium, will divide by what's called binary fission, which literally means splitting in two. And so to do this, of course, they have to undergo DNA replication preparatory to this as well, right? You have to have DNA, a complete set of DNA for both of the two daughter cells. So that's occurring in here. And then kind of like in an animal cell, you have basically the same thing as a cleavage furrow forming until it pinches off and you have two brand new bacteria. Which, if they're well fed, you know, this can happen every 20 minutes. So the population of bacteria, if they have food, doubles every 20 minutes, which is why a single cell, invisible to your eye on a plate, becomes a colony that you can see the next day, made up of millions of cells coming from that one cell originally. Okay, now to 10. Here we're looking at the cell cycle again, but the question here is, how is this thing controlled? A cell has to be able to control its progress through the cell cycle if things are going to go smoothly. And what you see as red marks here are called checkpoints in the cell cycle. Checkpoints are not actually physical gates. They're not actual things. Checkpoints are really just a set of conditions. So when conditions are correct, which in itself signals the correct situation inside the cell and outside the cell, then the cell can be allowed to proceed from one part of the cell cycle to the next. All right? And so what are these conditions? Well, it's really just a set of molecules. There's a chemical basis for it, but early on, when we were just figuring this out, we can't just say that in science. You can't just say something is true. You have to demonstrate it. So in slide 11, we're looking at experimental evidence for there being a chemical basis to the control of the cell cycle. Here we have an S-phase cell and a G1-phase cell. So they're in different parts of their cell cycle. And if they are experimentally fused into one cell, even though the G1 phase is before the S phase, right? So it's earlier in the cell cycle. As soon as you fuse that with a cell that's in the S phase, the nucleus from the G1 immediately replicates itself. So that kind of shows you that there's some sort of signal telling that cell, go on to the next part of interphase, S phase. Even more drastic is if you fuse an M phase one that's already in mitosis with a G1, not even close to mitosis at all, right? It hasn't gone through S or G2, let alone M. But when you fuse these two together, the G1 nucleus will immediately start, well, it will try to divide. It can't be successful because it hasn't replicated its genome yet through the S phase. But it's getting the signal, it thinks it's supposed to be mitotic. So it's good evidence that there is some chemical signaling involved here. And indeed, there is. Slide 12 shows you the main players in this game. Now, there's a lot of different proteins involved in this, but two major ones are called, well, one major one are called cyclins. Cyclins are proteins that get their name because they go up and down in concentration, depending on what part of the cell cycle they're in. So notice on the top, we're looking at three different cell cycles, at least parts of three different cell cycles, right? And the mitotic cyclin, which is the blue line here, notice it starts low when a cell is just created from mitosis of a previous cell, and then builds up, reaches a high concentration, and then when that cell divides into two new cells, it goes back down to a low concentration. And so its concentration is dependent on its position in the cell cycle. That's why it's called a cyclin. Now, there's not just one cyclin. That's a category of proteins, okay? And so on the bottom, we can see different kinds of cyclins. Notice that they have their peak at different parts within the cell cycle. This is because the different kinds of checkpoints, transition from G1 to S, for instance, is one checkpoint. There's also a transition from G2 to M. Well, those different checkpoints are under the control of different kinds of cyclins. Well, cyclins by themselves really don't do anything. We're on slide 13 now. What they do, though, is interact with proteins that operate as enzymes, and these proteins are called CDKs for short, but that stands for cyclin-dependent kinase. And you already know kinases is a major kind of enzyme, right, that are responsible for what? Phosphorylation of other things. Phosphorylation is a major way of switching something either on or off, right, and therefore causing something to happen or not. So these cyclin-dependent kinases only have their kinase activity, they only are operating enzymes, if they are associated with a cyclin, if a cyclin binds to them, in other words. That's why they're dependent. Well, the CDKs are basically always there throughout the cell cycle, but they just aren't doing anything unless they are activated by binding to a cyclin of the right type. All right. Once you have binding of a cyclin to the corresponding cyclin-dependent kinase, the combination of the two operates, allows the kinase to operate as a kinase and phosphorylate things, causing things to happen. So even though the kinase is there all the time, until the cyclin concentration gets high enough for there to be enough to bind to these kinases, nothing will happen. And the checkpoint really is the situation where you have enough cyclin buildup for it to turn on these cyclin-dependent kinases, and that's what causes transition to the next phase in the cell cycle. All right? So all sorts of different things happen because these kinases will phosphorylate different things. And so you can see a list of, in this case, this is the mitotic cyclin-dependent kinase because it's controlling the checkpoint between G2 and M phase. But it causes these things in blue to happen. It's important, though, for those things to be temporary, right? So in addition to all these four numbered things, it's shown in blue that this activated kinase is controlling. It also causes formation of this anaphase-promoting complex in orange, which is a thing that basically is going to destroy the action of the kinase itself. So the kinase brings about its own inactivation. And because that's because this anaphase-promoting complex will break down the cyclin. This is where the cyclin concentration gets low again and has to start build up again in the next cell. Okay? Only when it builds up again will it bind to the CDK and cause another transition to M phase in the next generation of cell. This last slide, it's fine if you need to leave, but since it's the last slide, I'm going to finish it. This has to do with what is called apoptosis, an often mispronounced word. It looks like it's apoptosis, it's apoptosis. And apoptosis is programmed cell death. Now, cells can die because they're injured, for instance. That's necrosis. Something going wrong with them is, you know, actually being physically torn apart by an injury or something. That's necrosis. Apoptosis, though, is a cell that is actually programmed to die genetically. And nothing has to be wrong with it for that to happen. It's just naturally supposed to die at a certain point, which is why, you know, as part of development, some features that are there originally are not there as an adult, so they get eliminated. That's an example of apoptosis. But apoptosis can also happen because something goes wrong in the cell, you know, like genetically something happens that is going to, if you allow that cell to undergo cell division, you're going to make two defective cells again, right? So that's another reason why a cell would be triggered to go into apoptosis. But apoptosis involves these changes that you see here. Basically, the cell disintegrates itself from within. It doesn't want to just explode because it's going to release a bunch of enzymes that could damage other cells. So it disintegrates its interior, disables its various proteins and its DNA before it actually gets eaten. And eventually it will be phagocytized by another cell of the body as debris at that point. But what signals the phagocytic cell to recognize the apoptotic cell is that as part of this disintegration, enzymes called flipases are activated that will flip phospholipids around so that the inward facing ones are facing outward, and that will be a flag to the phagocytic cell saying this one has been flagged for death, so go ahead and engulf it and eat it. Okay, that's it.